This morning we'd like to read from our classic Shastra in India. The Christians, they often talk about the Word of God, but actually their Bible is not literally the Word of God, but it's an assembled group of texts written by the followers and etc. of Moses and Jesus about God. But the literal Word of God we find actually in Gita. Bhagavad Gita. Bhagavad refers to Bhagavan. Parashara Muni, he described God as that person who owns all opulences. And he said that definition is Bhagavan. Bhagavan means he who owns all opulences. So, Bhagavad Gita. Gita means the song. So, Bhagavad Gita literally means the song of God. Not just the word, but the song of God. In higher circles, in heavenly planets, Sanskrit is sung. It's not spoken. And we hear from Brahma Samhita that in the spiritual world, every step is a dance, every word is a song, and there's a festival every day. Very beautiful description of heaven, of the spiritual sky. So when Lord comes to this material world for our benefit, for our emancipation, for our spiritual deliverance, he speaks Gita, he sings Gita to Arjuna. And Arjuna's a person, of course, he's the historic personality in Mahabharata. And he's the friend of Krishna. But for the Gita to be spoken, he becomes a student of Krishna. It appears that he falls into illusion. And Krishna has to speak Gita, but actually Krishna is speaking Gita for the benefit of all humanity. Not just one disciple. An important person goes somewhere. When the president of our country goes somewhere, Mr. Bush, he doesn't go just to a foreign country just to meet one person. He's going with a mission to meet many people and effect a great change. So when God comes to this world, he comes for the benefit of all humanity. So he spoke the Gita to Arjuna, for our benefit. So it's not about God, it's spoken directly by God. Who knows more about God than God? Who knows more about you than you? So if we want to know God, about God, if that's our goal in life, to know God, we have this extra advantage in our Vedic culture that we're hearing directly from the Lord Himself. Nice. So this, we've chosen the third chapter called Karma Yoga, a very famous verse. Saha Yagna Praja Shrishtva Puru Bhatsha Prajapati Anena Prashavishadham Esho Tvadishtakamaduk. Translation. In the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generation of men and demigods along with sacrifice for Vishnu and blessed them by saying, be thou happy by this yajna, the sacrifice, because its performance will bestow upon you everything desirable for living happily and achieving liberation. Purport. Material creation by the Lord of creatures, Vishnu, is a chance offered to the conditioned souls to come back home, back to Godhead. All living entities within the material creation are conditioned by material nature because of their forgetfulness of the relationship to Vishnu or Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. The Vedic principles are to help us understand this eternal relation. As is stated in the Bhagavad Gita, Vedaischa Shavar Aham Eva Vedya. The Lord says that the purpose of the Vedas is to understand Him. Very important verse, Bhagavad Gita. Because in this verse, we learn the secret for obtaining all prosperity. And when we're prosperous, we can dedicate ourselves fully to dharma or religion. I travel in many parts of the world which are not as affluent as this great country of America, very poor parts of the world, Central America, South America, different parts of Asia, even in Russia. And people are so much struggling to acquire the basic necessities of life. And they're so much disturbed by different diseases and harassed by different governments. They have no time for this ultimate goal of life. Savai pumsham pada dharmo yato bhaktir dhoksaje haitakiya patiyata yayatma shrupashirati. The supreme occupation for all mankind is that by which one can attain to the loving service of God. Such service to God must be unmotivated and uninterrupted in order to completely satisfy the self. That's the param gati. The goal of life is not necessarily education and career and family, although those things are important. The ultimate goal of life is to become self-realized, to become God-conscious. So if you're too much struggling, you can't do that. So here Krishna says, what is the secret to prosperity? Or you could say in modern vernacular language, economic development, economy. Now America is struggling with the economy. They should read Gita. Here Krishna says the secret to a successful economy is not necessarily hard work and the sweat of our brow. That has to be there. We can't be lazy people. But ultimately, all prosperity is given by God. It's bestowed upon us as a boon by God. Why God? Why Krishna? Because Upanishads say, Nitya Nityanam Chaitanas Chaitananam Ekabahanam Yovadi Dati Kamam. Out of all the eternal beings, and there's so many, even in this room there's trillions, there's one, Eka, who is fulfilling the desires of everyone. And is God. Nitya nityanam chaitanas chaitanam ekobahanam yo vididatikamam. There's one personality who's fulfilling the desires of everyone. That is God. In one sense, he's obliged, God, because he's the Supreme Father. Krishna says in Gita, I am the seed-giving father of all living entities. He doesn't say just the Hindus. Krishna is known in India, but he's also the father of the Americans and the Canadians and the Mexicans and the Germans. They just don't know who God is. They believe in God, they don't know who God is. This is our beauty of our Vedic culture. We know who is Bhagavan. We have various names for him. Ram, Nisringa, Vamanadev, Prithvikaram, Krishna, but yes, you have many names also. You have your first name, your middle name, your last name, your pet name. Your wife calls you honey or sugar. So that everything and everyone comes from him. Aham savasya pabavo matta sarva parthate. Krishna says, I'm the source of all that is material and all that is spiritual. We have one common father. And a father, he's obliged to take care of the children. It's his natural inherent duty. Isn't it? You can't just be irresponsible, conceive children, and then abandon them to the wild. You have a responsibility practically until you die. When they're infants, you know, mommy's changing diapers and giving the bottle, and daddy's out working, and, you know, all that baby stuff. Then they go to school, then comes university. Not because they're grown up, you no longer have a responsibility. And then they graduate, and is the responsibility finished? No. There's so much emotional turmoil in life, you have to be there for your kids. And even when they have their own children, they're all bewildered. How to take care of the screaming baby, mommy? And grandma comes. It's our Vedic culture. Extended family. The grandmother comes and helps her daughter take care of her new children. So, should we deny the same to the Supreme Father? In a sense, he has an obligation to take care of us. Even the rebellious ones, the bad ones. Because we're the bad guys. This material world is called Durga Dham. It's not the spiritual world. There's two worlds. Parastasmatu bhavanyo vyakto vyakta shanatana. This world is sometimes manifest, sometimes manifest. That world, the spiritual world, is eternal. Full of knowledge and bliss. That's our original home. Not Tawako, not Delhi, not Bangalore, not Chennai. Our original home is the spiritual world. We were sent here because we were rebellious. We rebelled against God. We didn't want to follow all the rules, all the regulations. We didn't want to be His humble servant. There was some little envy in the heart. He's the big fish, we're the little fish. Little envy. It's, as the Christians say, the cardinal sin. And we came here to this penitentiary. This is a penitentiary. It's meant to, not just to enforce suffering on us. Birth, disease, old age, death. No. God is not sadistic. But it's like a correctional institution where we are reformed to the point where we eventually understand, I can't be happy without God. I have my family, I have my bank balance, I have my material possessions, but I can't be happy without God. I have to include God in my life also. The whole purpose of material creation is to bring us to our senses that we can't be happy without God, and to try to go home to the spiritual world. But even though we're rebellious, even though we've forgotten God, He has not forgotten us. This is a good dad, a good father. The son leaves home and tries to forget the parents. It doesn't happen so much in your Indian families, but you may observe this Western culture in America. Sometimes it is that the kids leave home and they completely disregard the parents. They disown the parents. But the parents are always thinking of the children. So although we left the spiritual world and we forgot God, and we're trying our best to forget Him, He never forgets us. And He's obliged, to some degree, to maintain us. This is amazing, actually. Although we have Bahirmukha, Jagadananda Pandit says in his Prema Vivarta, we've turned our face from Him. Still, He's so kind that He's maintaining us. But don't think that He's working 24/7 to maintain us. No. He delegates the responsibility. Any intelligent man, he delegates responsibility. All these big companies you see here in America, you're driving down the highway and there's all these big, tall buildings and, you know, there's a CEO, the chief, the big boss. You think he's doing all the work? So then why do they have so many offices in those buildings? No. He's delegating the responsibility. He's probably just sitting home in his mansion somewhere in, you know, upstate New York. So God is like that. Don't think God is like the Christian concept. He's like holding the earth up and he's working hard and, you know, we're praying for bread and God, he's up there baking, you know, and throwing the bread down. He's, no. He's a vigyanashwarat. He's all-knowing and completely independent. By his will, it's all going on. It's by his will it's all happening. And he delegates the responsibility. Who does he delegate it to? Providing us all the necessities of life, like the rain and the sunshine and the wind and the resultant food grains and the vegetables and the fruits and all of that. Who does he delegate it to? Some of his devotees, they're called demigods. They're half-gods. Half-gods in the sense that they're much more powerful than us, but they're not as powerful as the Supreme Ishwar. Ishwara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karana Karanam. Ishwara Parama Krishna. Out of all these like amazing personalities who do these superhuman things we read about in our scriptures, like Indra pouring down the rain, Vayu controlling the wind, Vivishwan controlling the sunshine, Brahma the creator, Shiva the destroyer. You hear them, but wow. They're very powerful, but they're not independent. They're actually jivatmas like you and me, but very, very pious, so they've been elevated to position of devatas. And by the mercy of the Supreme Ishwara, they're able to perform their functions. Just like our Mr. Bush, we'll only be saying his name for a few more months, and then we'll have either Mr. McCain, Mr. Obama or Mrs. Clinton. But when they get elected, they have their cabinet. And they delegate responsibilities to the different cabinets and ministries and so on. This is God. He deputes these amazing personalities to do these things. And if we don't have a complete picture of Vedic knowledge, we think, oh, we hear about Brahma, we hear about Shivji, we hear about Ganesh, we hear about Durga, and we think, oh, they must be Bhagavan, because they're so powerful. We have to see the complete picture. How even they are getting their powers from the Supreme Bhagavan, from Krishna. They're not independent. God delegates. He's not doing all the work. Like here in America, many of you have lived here for many years, some of you have just immigrated here, but part of the American history that your children are learning, because they have to learn American history, we have our famous Mark Twain, great author, and he wrote one novel about Tom Sawyer. And one day this fictional character, Tom Sawyer, he was painting. His father said, you can't go out and play today. Actually, he wanted to go fishing. You can't go fishing. You stay home and you paint the fence around the property, whitewash it. But Tom's a typical boy. He wants to go and play. He doesn't want to work, mow the lawn, pick the weeds, pick up his room. He's a typical boy. He wants to go and play. Father says, no, you whitewash the fence. So Tom's out there whitewashing the fence. And his friends, a group of friends walk by on the way to go fishing. They're laughing at him. Ha, 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 Tom, you have to stay home and whitewash the fence. We're going fishing. But he was a smart boy. He said, no, I don't even want to go fishing. This whitewashing the fence is so much fun. And he gets this big smile on his face. And he's la, la, la. Fishing, that's just the kid stuff. This is like fun. Look at it. Whoa, and he's going back. And his friend said, oh, really? He said, yep. And his friend said, can we do it? He said, nope. I'm not going to share this with you. Look, I've got this whole yard to whitewash. It's going to take me all day, and I love every minute of it. Oh, come on, Tom. Let us whitewash the fence with you. Nope, sorry. Please. Well, if you give me $5 each, I'll share it with you. So they all, you know, he's this boy. They all give him $5. So they're out there, and he just picks up the fishing pole and goes. And so God's like that. He's not 24/7 doing the work. He delegates it. Who would want to do all that administration in the heavens? It's a lot of work. But these devatas, they're not liberated souls. Some of them are, of course, but there's millions of demigods, actually. But they're kind of like you and me. They're jivatmas, they're spirit souls, part and parcel of God, but they still have some material desires. They're godly, they're on the path of transcendence, but they're mixed devotees, you could say. They're devotees of Vishnu, they're devotees of God, but they still have some attachments to this world, just like most of us. We're also very interested in religion, but we're also interested in other things too. We're called mixed devotees. That's okay. Confucius said the longest journey begins with the first step. So we're devotees, but we have our kind of personal interests, so our material. So these devatas who live in the heavenly shvarglok, like that, who are controlling all these functions of nature, they have mixed devotion. So God says, okay, you can be my devotee, at the same time you can fulfill your material ambitions. And in due course of time, you'll find that satisfying those material desires is not as good as full surrender to me. And then you'll become my devotees. It's like you let a child play with things for a while, then he kind of matures and wants something more important and more important, and finally he's an adult. So the path back to the spiritual world is a gradual path. Our whole system of varnashram dharma is actually gradual detachment from this world and full surrender to God. That takes a long time to become a pure devotee of God. Vasudeva sarvamiti sa mahatma sadurlabha. Krishna says after many, many births, those who are in full knowledge surrender to me. So it's a kind of an interesting relationship. God needs the world to be administered, and there's some people who want to play like that, do like that in his service. So this is devata. These devatas, they never think they're supreme. They may have their followers who worship them and fight amongst themselves. Oh no, Brahma is supreme. No, Shivji is supreme. No, Vishnu. They have wars. You know, the history of South India, there was a period where the devotees of Vishnu and the devotees of Shivji, they were fighting. They had whole kings, and they had huge wars, and many men died just to establish who was supreme. And even now, I know I was visiting a temple recently in England, and they asked me to come in and help give some guidance, and they didn't know who to install on the altar as supreme. Everyone, different part of India, no, this, he should be here, he should be. There was all this fighting, and the whole thing practically fell apart. So they installed everybody like that. No, that's okay. We should know there's always higher authority, but we should also know the conclusion. Ishvara Parama Krishna Satchidananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarvakarana Karanam. There's one supreme Devata, one supreme Ishvara, Krishna. And Devatas, they are worshipping him, just like our beloved Shivji. Once he was sitting in Kailash with Bharavati on his lap. And on this earth planet, the Ramayana was taking place. And Sita had been kidnapped by that evil ten-headed Rakshasa, Ravan. We don't even like to say his name in such a holy place as this, in front of the Lord. Ravan. He took the goddess of fortune to enjoy her with his lusty senses. But he couldn't do. You know, she was in the Ashoka garden for a long time, a tender, thin, somewhat emaciated, but beautiful goddess, and this huge hulk of a demon, Rakshasa, man-eater, Ravana, who could defeat even the demigods. He wanted to enjoy her. He could never do. Why? Did you ever wonder why he couldn't touch her and enjoy her, his lusty desires? Because when he was a young man, he violated one maiden. And her father heard about this, and he cursed the young Ravana. If you ever touch a woman, try to enjoy a woman, without her consent, your head will split into 100,000 pieces. Ravana was cursed. Even though he had the goddess of fortune, he couldn't enjoy her. In the same way, even though we have all this opulence, which is manifest from the goddess of fortune, we can't really enjoy it. You can only enjoy it when you use it in the service of Narayan. Lakshmi cannot, she's very chaste. She only has one husband, Narayan. So you can't enjoy her unless you're engaging her as she likes to be engaged in the service of Bhagavan. That's the secret. So anyway, Hanuman came and he found Sita. And he came back and told Ram and Lakshman and the multitude of monkeys and bears, their army. So you know the story. There was this great exodus south across the ocean to Sri Lanka. There's a huge battle between good and evil, between Ravana and Ram. Fight. And finally, to make a long story short, because you could speak for years the Ramayana, but to make a long story, Ram took his bow and he placed the arrow there and aimed it at the heart of Ravana. He said, "You dog, you're just like a dog who has stolen food from the master. I am now going to send you to the abode of Yamaraj." And he's just ready to. And Parvati's watching this from her the heavenly abode, and she says to her husband, "Prabhuji," because in Vedic culture the wife never addresses the husband by his first name. There's always that formality because the husband is one of the gurus of the wife. He's Pati Guru. He's not just making money. He's not the breadwinner, but he's also a spiritual guide for the wife. So she never addresses him by first name. He never addresses her by, he always says Devi. She's also representing the goddess of fortune. This is the beauty of our culture. It's all being lost now. It's all getting absorbed in this hellish Western culture. We won't go into that right now. She says, "Prabhuji, just see, your devotee is about to be killed. You should save him." Ravana was a great devotee of Shiva. Because Shiva, he's Ashutosh. He's easily pleased and he's easily displeased. You can just offer him that flower. What do they call that flower in India? That red flower? It's a special flower that you use in the Shiva Puja. That's all you have to offer him. He wants to see your devotion. And he gives these, you could say, material benedictions. Because some people come to the temple just for material benedictions. They don't know the higher purpose of getting love of God. So Ravana, he was very paka, devotee of Shiva. And Shiva blessed him with so many boons. He could fight the devatas and defeat them and conquer Bhur Bhuvaha Shvaha. He could conquer Shvaglok. He was so powerful by the grace of Shiva. So then Parvati says, hey, this Ramchandra is going to kill your devotee. You should protect him. He's very devoted to you. So Shiva turned to Devi. He said, Devi, Rake Krishna Marike, Mare Krishna Rakike. Bhagavan wants to kill someone, no one can save them. And if Bhagavan wants to save someone, no one can kill him. So Parvati became quiet. The wife is always submissive to husband. She didn't want to argue the point. No sense arguing. When there's argument between husband and wife, the wife, and it's going to, there's no resolution, wife should just concede. Okay, Prabhu. And if she wants to win the argument, she should cry. Because a woman's ultimate weapon is her tears. Any man will fall down at the feet. Okay, Devi, please stop crying, whatever you want. I want this, this. So, from this lila, from this pastime, we can understand Shivji, as great as he is, he's not jiva-tattva like you and me, he's shiv-tattva. He's in between jiva-tattva and Krishna-tattva or Vishnu-tattva. He's in his own special category. He's a divine personality. But he himself looks to the lotus feet of Shankarshan, one of the expansions of Krishna. So we worship these devatas, but we should understand their hearts. They themselves know they're getting their energy from the Supreme Ishwar. So the scientists are thinking it's all going on by some mechanical laws. They read our books and they think, oh, this is mythology. All this, you know, God, bluish black like a monsoon cloud with beautiful black cascading hair, wearing a peacock feather and a crown, playing a flute, frolicking with cows in the forest, who has his milkmaids and his mother and father. This is all like mythology. And these four-headed beings and beings with, you know, heads of an elephant and, you know, eyes all over their bodies and, you know, this is mythology. What do they know? They're like a frog in a well. This material creation is so vast, what to speak of the spiritual creation. They're like an ant in a corner of the room. And all they see is this little fiber around them and a couple of grains of sugar. They're speculating on what we're doing here. We're like devatas to them. What do we know on this one speck of dust in this huge universe, which is like a universe in a mustard seed, a bag of mustard seed universes? What do they think? They don't know. What can they see with their telescope? The ant can see as far as the plant, and that's about it. You know? There's this house, and there's this city, and there's this world, and there's a universe. They're like frogs in the well. One time, a frog was in his well, and another frog came from the Atlantic Ocean and jumped into his well. Boom! And they started talking, frog talk. And the frog in the well said, "Croak, croak. Where have you come from?" "Oh, I've come from the Atlantic Ocean." "Oh, it's like my well?" "No, sir. It's very big." "Oh, you mean like this big?" He puffed himself. "Oh, no, no, sir. The ocean is very much bigger than your well." "Oh, you mean like like this?" "No, no, no. You can't understand. Just accept." "Oh, you mean..." He popped. The scientists are like that. They're very intelligent, but Gita says their intelligence is stolen by illusion. They don't use their intelligence to understand the absolute truth. They use their intelligence to exploit the material energy for the gratification of their senses. It's called hedonism. They're very prim and very proper and very educated and very elegant. But the goal of life is the same as the cats and dogs or the gladiators of Rome. Eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. And these scientists, they say there's no soul, there's no supreme soul, there's no God, and this world around us is just working by mechanical laws. It's all happening by chance. No. Frog in a well. What you can know with your imperfect senses and your little place like that. Better they follow one of their own, Einstein. Einstein, he once said, after studying this whole creation, I have come to the conclusion. What is it, Mr. Einstein? What if you're one of us? You're our leader. He said this one day. I have come to the conclusion that there's an intelligent being behind it. Oh, we're very disappointed. We're so disappointed that you're so. Maybe you're getting a little senile. So to really know him, they took his brain and put it in formaldehyde, and they're picking it apart, I understand. So like this. Actually, it's not. There is Brahma, there is Shiva, there is Ganesh, there is Durga. They're there. They're on these other planets. The moon is a celestial planet with rivers of nectar and devatas with subtle bodies and apsaras and chanting of the Vedas. And they go there and they just see what? Some dirt. But how you can see these beings? Because you don't have the eyes to see them. You can see what you're qualified to see, gross matter. But these devatas have subtle bodies. Earth, air, fire, water, mind, intelligence, and false ego. So these are the material elements. So we have bodies made of water, basically. 70% of our body is water. It's a material element. But in higher planets, they have the more subtle material elements like mind, intelligence, and ego. So don't think that there's not beings living on the sun planet. Vivishwan lives there. But subtle, you can't see. You're not qualified to see. If you're not qualified, you won't see. It's like you have to come here to America, you have to be qualified, you have to have a visa. So these are very subtle things, but we have to learn from higher authority, Guru, Shastra, and Sadhu. So anyway, he's deputing. You look there in the sky. Bhagavan is deputing all these demigods to do this work. But ultimately it's coming from him. Nitya nityanam chaitanas chaitanam ekabhanam yovididatikamam. He's giving, and we know the system by which he's distributing. And we're getting it in the form of fruits, grains, vegetables, milk products, cotton, wool. Where's it all coming from? You can work and get it, but you didn't create it. You didn't make the milk, you didn't make the wool, you didn't make the metals, the copper. Where's it all coming from? It just fell out of the sky? Well, someone made it. We talk about material nature. Whose nature? You say this material nature, but whose nature is it? Gita says it's from Krishna. He's giving to you. He's so kind. You have to recognize that. You have to appreciate that. If you get a gift from somebody and you don't say thank you, do you think you're going to get another gift? We're getting all of this. We're putting on the table at night and we're just eating. Ah, good food. Yum, yum, yum. That's not right. My father taught me, I remember. Yeah, I'm a kid, right? I get a present. He say thank. Say thank you. No, say thank you. No, say thank you. Thank you. You know, children are just they're running around. But you get a gift, you have to say thank you. What if your wife gives you a present? You know, your wife gives you a present. You're busy. You just kind of ignore her, and she's so hurt. Or you give her something, and she's too busy. You're hurt. God is giving all of this And we don't even say thank you. It'll be withdrawn. You watch. It will gradually be withdrawn. Because the situation was better even 5,000 years ago. When Krishna was here, we hear how, we read in the Bhagavad, in the Srimad Bhagavad, how opulent this earth was. In fact, there wasn't just rain puddles, there were milk puddles. The cows were so happy because they weren't being killed. They were being protected. They're Krishna's favorite animal. They were protecting the cows. The milk was just flowing from their milk bags, and there were puddles of milk everywhere. And there was an abundance of fruits and grains and vegetables, and, you know, people were mainly working a little bit in the agricultural field, planting, watering, and harvesting. Prabhupada said they worked 7 months of the year, and 5 months of the year they had off. Nowadays we don't even have one moment free. We come home dead tired, fall asleep on the pillow, get up in the morning, drink a cup of coffee, wait in the traffic 2 hours to get to work. And we're so tired on Saturday and Sunday we can't even play with our kids. We fall asleep. And then we get 2 weeks of vacation. And it's such a passionate thing on the motorway to get there, to drive with an airplane ride back to India, and, you know, so many problems to solve, and it's life. But Vedic philosophy was simple living with high thinking. Nowadays it's complicated life with no time to think. How progressive really are we? So this is all coming by God's arrangement. I have to say thank you. So how do you say thank you? Krishna says in this verse, in the beginning of creation, the Lord of all creatures sent forth generations of men and demigods, along with sacrifice for Vishnu, and bless them, that by doing this sacrifice, whatever you desire will be bestowed upon you. You'll live happily and achieve liberation. That's the way we... You know what a yogi is? We're thinking, Om Swaha, Swaha, ah, ah, ah. You know, we're sitting there very rigid, and this is part of our Hindu tradition. The son is asking, Daddy, why do we have to do this anyway? Shut up. Let's do it. But what is it? What is the essence? What is the meaning? You know, to do things without understanding the purpose behind them, that's not very advanced. It's like, thanks. There's a prescribed way. You know, God's a person. He has his likes. Like you, he has his likes. He has his dislikes. This is how he has said in our Vedic tradition. This is how you say thank you. It's an expression of love. In days of yore, we had the Agnihotra. The king would actually tax the people, because the kings were Raja Rishis. They weren't just like, you know, our modern politicians. I don't want to get in trouble in case there's any FBI agents here. But the kings were not just like, you know, there to do a job so they could put some money in the Swiss bank account, pocket the money. No, they understood they had to fulfill the people's material needs, and they had to fulfill the people's spiritual needs. They were making sure that religion was going on. They didn't separate the church from the state. You know, they were very involved with the brahmanas and like everything. So they would take the tax money of the people and they would give it to the brahmanas, one big Rajashuya sacrifice. One big sacrifice you do. So much, crores of rupees would be spent on, you know, milking the cows and getting the ghee and harvesting the grains and building a huge fire and giving charity to the brahmanas. And then there would be a big, huge sacrifice, and it would be so successful that the demigods would come down to receive the offerings on behalf of Vishnu. And the common man could see them. The common man could see Indra, he could see Ganesh, he could see Saraswati, he could see Durga, he could see Lakshmi. They would come and they would hover above the Yajnashala, and the priests, they would never touch the ground because they wanted contact with the world of mortals. They wouldn't touch, you know, our territory. They would hover. If you ever see somebody walking and their feet are above the ground, hey, he's a demigod. And they would take it and then they would offer it to Vishnu. Yajna Vai Vishnu. Yajna is meant ultimately for Vishnu. The demigods would offer to Vishnu. That was in days of yore. Now you can't, it's hard to find ghee. Now they use margarine. One time my spiritual master was performing a vivaha yajna, a marriage ceremony for one of his couples and disciples. And it was, the temple wasn't very rich, so I don't see the old days. They didn't have ghee, so they used margarine. And Prabhupada was ready to do the yajna, and he poured the svaha, the margarine, and the fire went out. I said, what is this? He didn't know it was margarine. He thought it was ghee. So he said, this marriage is not starting out on a very good footing. And the girl broke down, cried. It was actually the marriage of Jamuna and Gurudas. And eventually that boy took sannyas. So like that. Real wealth is ghee and milk and butter and yogurt and ice cream. Not nuts and bolts and factories. This is the real thing. Cows and grains, this is. So, yes, we have to do the yoga. And if we don't, we're thieves. What's the definition of a thief? He takes something that doesn't belong to him. So we take it. This is mine. This is my house. This is my garden. This is my car. This is my land. This is my. Yes, it's in your care, but who does it really belong to? It belongs to God. God giveth and God taketh away. So while it's in your possession, God's kind, He gives it to you so you can live a prosperous life so that you can worship Him and become God conscious. This is not your wife, this is not your husband, your children. You're just meeting them. The souls are crossing paths in the eons of time, and in this life she's your wife, and you're her husband, she's your children. It's not your house. You're here today and gone tomorrow. In the history of that house, so many families will live, this is our house. This is all Maya. It's all God's. And we are living in His palace, and we're His servants. And the servant is allowed to share the same opulence as the king. The servant can eat the same food as the king, wear the same clothes as the king, sleep in the same palace. That's okay. As soon as he starts thinking, I am king, they kick him out. So we are all God's children living in His palace, this world. And we if we take and we don't acknowledge this as God's, we're thieves, and a thief is always punishable by the laws of nature. And so this mentality of I, me, and mine, it means that we're living here, but we're punished birth after birth. Disease, old age, death, it's not. This material world is no place for a lady or a gentleman. Oh, I'm not taking so much. Look at what's his name? Bill Gates. He's a very big thief. I only make $100,000 a year. Big thief, little feet. If you steal a diamond ring or you steal cucumber, you steal. In India, when they catch a thief, you know what it's like. Not like here in the West, they call the police. I've seen so many times in India, in the villages when they catch a thief, they beat the guy to a bloody pulp. Am I correct? Well, we call that vigilante. Whatever it is, he just steals a cucumber from the market. Thief, thief! Everyone, okay, oh, I'm going to kill the guy. One time I had to you're going to kill the guy, stole a cucumber, Then they wanted to fight me. Okay, all right. How do you... Shadu. You shadu? I had to quote a verse. Sarvadharman pradichaja mamik... Oh, shadu. Very light skin from... I'm from Gujarat. One time Alexander the Great, Alexander from Macedonia, he conquered all of Asia Minor. And he was going and he got into India. Thank God that he was repelled from India by some pious devotees. long story. So one time he had conquered that, and then he was in India, and then one thief was caught. So that thief was brought to Alexander, because the kings would sometimes hold court like that in the villages. So he was a very powerful man, Alexander, very tall, handsome, powerful, and enjoying the fruits of his battles. And this thief who had stolen some bread was brought before him, and Alexander says, "So what has he done?" "Oh, sir, he has stolen a loaf of bread. You cut off his hand." "The thief, can I cut off my hand? I stole a loaf of bread." "No, you cut off his hand. He's a thief." So this thief was smart. He said, "Sir, what is your definition of a thief?" And Alexander said, "Someone who takes forcibly something that doesn't belong to him." So the thief said, "Sir, I have stolen a loaf of bread. You have stolen half the world from so many kings. You're a bigger thief than me. So if they cut off my hand, they should cut off your head." So Alexander blushed. "I pardon you. You get away very quickly. You go away. Go away." Like that. So you steal little, you steal a lot. You steal a thief. So we can't take a farthing. We can't take a rupee. We can't take paise. We can't take penny without acknowledging to whom it belongs. This is a true devotee of God. We have, and to acknowledge it, it just means you don't have to renounce it. God's, again, he's obliged to give you. So you take what you need. Ishvasham idam sarvam yat kinja yagatyam jagat tena taktena bunjitaha margidaha kashashidhanam. Everything that moves or doesn't move in his creation is owned and controlled by the Lord. Therefore, one should take what is necessary for himself, but leave the rest aside. Like Gandhi said, the problem is not people are taking according to their need. Problem is everyone's taking according to their greed. Therefore, we see a lack of facility in this world. So a sannyasi, he doesn't need much. All his life's possessions can be here. Householder, he has children. He needs a house and car. But don't take more than your quota, and then we'll find that everyone can live harmoniously, happily in this world. This is the real formula for solving the environmental issue. This global warming, it's just because people are so greedy, they're taking more than they need, burning up the earth in their greed. The real solution to the environmental issue is simple living with high thinking. But you can only live a simple life if you're satisfied inside. We see in India so many sadhus, they have very little possessions, but their faces are shining with effulgence, because they're happy within. So this is our formula. So we need to thank God. So how do we thank God? That's called yajna. And in each age, there's a different yajna which is prescribed. Because, you know, we don't have the money now to put on these yajnas where, you know, lots of gold and cows and riches are offered to the brahmanas who distribute them themselves. You know, these are big, costly. We can't do that now. So therefore, in this age, the Lord has described in 11th canto of Bhagavad Purana, Krishna Varnam Tusha Krishnam Shango Pangasha Parshadam Yagnai Sankitan Prayar Yajantihi Shumarishaha. That the yajna in this age is much cheaper. Time, place, circumstance. What is it? A little pran. You give some of your life air to glorifying God by chanting his name. Vas. Harinam, Harinam, Harinam eva kevalam, kolo nasteva, 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 ghatir anyatat, brihad narayan purana. In the age of Kali, which is like the Iron Age, the age of quarrel and hypocrisy, the easiest means to perform yajna to satisfy the Supreme is to decorate your tongue with his holy name. There's so many incarnations. Raghupati Raghavadajaram Patita Pavana Sitaram Sitaram Jai Sitaram Sitaram Jai Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So in Indian culture, God has appeared through the ages in so many incarnations, so many forms to receive our offerings. In South India they have Lakshmi Narayan. In North India we have our Krishna. We have it at Nathwar. We have our deity holding up the Govardhan Hill. In Bengal, everywhere. So you're from a different part of India, that's okay, but you give your heart to Bhagavan and you glorify him by singing his name. Then, if the whole world did that, it would be a very prosperous place. All these big, you know, summits, the G7, they're coming together and talking about how to, you know, make the economy work. And here in America now, we're on the brink of a recession. What is our formula? Okay, instead of spending millions of dollars for these meetings and the government investing money in the, you know, the mortgages and the houses and this and that, just everyone go in New York City, tens of thousands of people, on one Harinam Sankirtan with drums and cymbals, and you chant, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And you see what happens. Do you think they'll accept that? No, no. This silly, what is this, chanting, singing, is it going to, you know, solve our recession? Yes, sir. It will. You put it into practice. But because you're so agnostic, or worse yet, you're atheistic, really, you don't believe in the power of God. That by God's mercy, it's all happening, and if you acknowledge it, then he can bless. Prabhupada said one time, our Krishna, he's no poor man. He's wearing Kashtubhya jewel. He's not mythological. He's not a maybe, a if, or... No. Krishna's there. Pure devotees can see him with their purified vision. God is there. And if we thank him through the performance of the prescribed method of yajna, which is chanting, no harm in doing the fire yajnas. That's part of our tradition as well. But special emphasis should be put on the Nam-Yajna. These are all instructions from God, but when someone gives you a set of instructions, the last instruction is the most important. So what is the most recent instruction? It's given by the latest incarnation of God, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the golden avatar who appeared in India 500 years ago and propagated this chanting of Hare Krishna. So if we follow this process of chanting, dancing and feasting, we'll get the best economy. Not that we do that for good economy, but again, you need a good economy so that you can peacefully sit with your family members and study Bhagavad Gita, chant Hare Krishna, make offerings of nice vegetarian food to your altar, invite your friends over for spiritual programs, and go to the temple. We don't have to solve the problems of life under nasty conditions like cats and dogs. By following this simple formula, our lives will be prosperous. Then, as Krishna says, we can easily achieve liberation or ultimately love of God. And that's how this philosophy of Bhagavad Gita applies even in our modern society. April 4th or 5th, I think, April 5th, 2008. Although this book was spoken 5,000 years ago, it's absolute truth. It applies in all phases of time, the past, the present, and the future. It's not outdated. It's meant for the prosperity, material and spiritual prosperity of humankind for eternity. And if we take advantage of it, we will be happy. Thank you very much. Bhagavad Gita as it is, ki?
Jai.
Srila Prabhupada ki?
Jai.
Good. Premanandi.